Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharakana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. Thanks for joining us. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we are joined by our guest, Guy Weston.
Guy has been engaged in genealogy research for over 25 years with a substantial focus on his maternal ancestors in Timbuktu, New Jersey, where his fourth great-grandfather bought his family's plot in 1829 for $30. His introduction to genealogy came when he had to do research to secure the title on his family's property. Most of his recent work has encompassed research and public history initiatives to raise the profile of Timbuktu and antebellum free African Americans in New Jersey history. These have included interpretive signage in Timbuktu, coordination of a curriculum development project in collaboration with local teachers, and preservation efforts for the Timbuktu Cemetery, where the oldest gravestone is dated 1847.
Guy currently serves as managing director of the Timbuktu Historical Society, is a visiting scholar at Rutgers University, and is the editor of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society Journal, or AHG. In addition, he is active in the Association for the Study of African-American Life, ASALH, in Philadelphia, and the James Dent Walker Campbell chapter of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society in Washington, D.C. He has contributed articles about his research to the AHG's Journal, AHG's News, National Genealogical Society Magazine, and New Jersey Studies. He maintains a website, which can be found at www.timbuktunj.com. He has a master's degree in bilingual bicultural studies from LaSalle University. Welcome to Speak On It, Guy Weston.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here because I always enjoy talking about these topics that we are so passionate about. I'm also extra excited, believe it or not, because this is an African-American group, it seems. And while I really appreciate interest from broader genealogy community, there's nothing like speaking to your own people. So thank you so much for inviting me, and I look forward to our discussion.
Aww.
Thank you for joining us, Guy. Please share with our listeners what Timbuktu is and where it's located.
So Timbuktu is located near Exit 5 of the New Jersey Turnpike. It's in West Hampton Township, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. It was founded by formerly enslaved and free Black people in 1826. We know that because our county clerk's office has deeds back to the late 1700s. So we've actually been able to go back and identify who the first residents were. And there's a lot of other information like that as well.
Awesome. So that kind of nicely flows into our next question. So Timbuktu, early residents included formerly enslaved and free persons. Can you tell us about some of these families and if any of them were historical figures who made a difference for and after slavery in New Jersey?
Well, certainly I should first clarify that Timbuktu is a relatively small community. It is an unincorporated settlement in Burlington County. So it has an identifier, but it was never a large settlement. The largest it ever was a few hundred people. And so there aren't a lot. It's not like a major city like Camden or Trenton that had a large group to draw from. But there are many, I'll say there are a few very interesting people that came from Timbuktu. Fortunately, we have a newspaper called the New Jersey Mirror, which was the local white paper of the area. You can actually Google, or not Google, but search Timbuktu in the New Jersey Mirror, and you get articles about people in Timbuktu. From that, we know, for example, there was a man named David Parker, who, while we don't read about him in history books, there was a famous battle called the Battle of Pine Swamp, in which slave catchers came from Maryland to capture a formerly enslaved person who lived in Timbuktu. There's a long story about how David Parker led the Timbuktu residents to basically run the slave catchers out of town. Wow. And it's a very dramatic and fascinating story because it's a story in which Black people, we always read about white people beating us down. When have you ever heard a story where slave catchers came to catch Black people? The Black people took bats and whatever they had to swing. And mm-hmm. there were maybe five slave catchers and 50 Timbuktu people, and they just ran them down the road. And it's a very inspiring story of victory of the type that we never read. I have never read a story where somebody came to catch a slave and the Black people said, get the Black people like out of here. You're not coming back here to take us back.
My first time hearing it. That's my first time ever hearing a story of that nature.
Same here.
Well, and then actually, I was going to say there were a couple history, of other, yeah. one other man was named Hezekiah Hall, who had been enslaved by Charles Carroll, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and the first elected senator from Maryland. He settled in Timbuktu, and he had the very substantial obituary in that paper. He wasn't a mover and shaker outside the community, but he was another person who had a lot of influence in terms of founding a school and being on the board of trustees of the local church. We had a school called the African Union School, which was established for Black people in 1834. The founders included one of my ancestors, whose name was Edward Giles, as well as three or four other. Hezekiah Hall was another person who was the founder of that school. And to think about founding a school for Black people by Black people, the incorporation information in the deed said you had to be a person of color who lived within 10 miles of the premises to be a trustee of that school. So these are hidden stories in the sense that they're not written in the history books, but they're written in our deed books in our county courthouse. And I think it's a very strong, inspiring story because if you read about Black people in schools in 1834, what you read about is we weren't allowed to know how to read or teach ourselves how to read. And if we did, we got hung. This is a story of how Black people established a school that said it's going to be our school. And they had actually a restrictive covenant, if you will, to make sure that Black people were always in charge. So they're unsung heroes. We have many of those. We don't have many people who are known broadly outside of our community.
That's definitely one of the for us, by us.
Right.
You know, for us, mm-hmm. by us. Mm-hmm. As managing director of the Timbuktu Historical Society, what are some collaborations that you are currently working on?
Well, there are many different collaborations to talk about. I think the first important one is that initially in 2019 and again in 2022, we got funding from our county parks department, which runs history programs, to develop a curriculum and materials to teach people about Timbuktu in middle school and high school. Because you could grow up in Timbuktu and have no clue that your ancestors were groundbreaking people, no clue that your community was something significant because it just wasn't taught. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, textbooks are national in focus and they don't have local stories anyway.
Right.
But in this particular case, this was a very important missing piece of history. So we got started in 2019, got slowed down by the pandemic. But we were able to present the curricula and materials at the New Jersey Education Association Conference in November in Atlantic City, which is a significant event for teachers in New Jersey. We're presenting at the Burlington County Education Association's conference in April of this year. And we only have three teachers working with us, and we have a very limited budget. But the idea, obviously, is to share the information with other teachers, make it available to them, and replicate it simply by letting people know that information that's available. And one thing about doing things like that is we always want credit for our work. Sometimes we want to be paid for our work. But if we, basically, I think we have to put it out there and let people use it. If we set up a structure where people have to get permission to pay for it and will their district approve it, it won't get out there fast. So our goal is for anybody who wants it to be able to use it. That's the most important collaboration we have, I think, because ultimately people will think differently about this period of history if they know about all of these accomplishments and achievements and positivity that occurred. Not to say that we didn't have discrimination and lynching like they existed all over the country, but right. we also had some achievements and resilience and victory that we want people to know about. I'm also working with one university professor from Francis Marion University in South Carolina was the principal investigator of Timbuktu archaeology about 12 years ago when we did an excavation here. He focuses on what's called collaborative archaeology, I think. His name is Dr. Christopher Barton. And I was surprised to learn that the archaeologists would dig and they'd find a brick and they'd say, oh, this is a cheap brick. These people obviously didn't have any money. Oh, this is an expensive brick. Obviously, this house was expensive. The people must have had resources. This jar that's broken says Dixie Peach. Gee, Black people must live here because white people don't use Dixie Peach hair pomade. He could look at, or they could look at pieces of broken mason jars and with information about the crops that were grown, talk about the diets of the people who live here. So archaeology has many different ways to learn about the past that most of us are not familiar with. And so I'm very happy that we're able to learn more about Timbuktu through archaeology and that we were fortunate enough to have a municipal government that actually paid for that archaeological work to be done initially. We're also doing cemetery preservation. There are many different projects. I shouldn't say many, there are a couple of different projects. One I will say, for example, is that our cemetery only has 11 marked graves, but we did ground penetrating radar. We have to have like 100 graves. The reason why we only have 11 marked graves was because during that period of time, I'm not talking the early decades, the entire 19th century actually, wooden grave markers were common for rank and file people. But if you are a U.S. colored trooper or anybody who served in the military, you got a gravestone from the government. So what we have left basically is the people that had wooden gravestones, those are all gone. The ones that were U.S. colored troops, those are still there. And so people think it's a U.S. colored troops cemetery when in fact it's a church cemetery. The troops were there because they were members of the church, not because it was a military cemetery.
Right.
Interesting. And so this is a very interesting story. When I wanted to take control of the cemetery so we can get funding to do preservation work, the owner of record was Colored Cemetery because the church dissolved 100 years ago and just different people in the neighborhood were taking care of it. They saw the U.S. Colored Troops sign, so they renamed it to Timbuktu Civil War Memorial Cemetery, and that was what people called it. Not knowing it was really a church cemetery. And so there's a thing where there are a lot of people that celebrate war, that celebrate military, that celebrate uniform, that aren't really interested in African American people, their civil rights, or our right. progress. And so they were all over the military part, and the Black history got totally lost. And so we did the research. We now have title to the cemetery. We put the proper name back on it. We put historic signage so people could understand what happened there. But the most important thing about that was it's not a military cemetery. It's not all about war. It's about Black community. It's about Black church. It's about Black freedom, the Black success, because Black people owned these properties. It wasn't a government military cemetery. That's our, and so there are all kinds of things that go along with that, because for example, the, and this happens very often, the legal boundaries of the plot are not the boundaries of the graves. We have graves 20 feet outside of the boundary. And so that adjacent lot is owned by the municipal government. And I, frankly, I wouldn't say this if I thought this were a television broadcast for the public, but I think if it's only a strip of 14 feet of the length of the lot, they should just give us that. Uh-huh. There's no reason to, for there to be any exchange. If it's a whole lot of, you know, 2 acres, then I guess we need to talk about finding a way to pay for it. So the advocacy around, first of all, to conduct another geophysical survey to, or ground penetrating radar is a more common term, to see what the boundaries of the graves actually are and then to protect those. And then there's all kinds of issues around, in some cases we have things like burial permits that even though we don't know where the people are, we know they're in the cemetery. We need to commemorate those people with some kind of signage.
Yes.
There's all kinds of archaeological work that can be done in cemeteries to learn things. There's history of the church associated with the cemetery. But there's lots of information in that cemetery. I wanted to say something about another cemetery. We have a second cemetery. So that was the Amy Zion Cemetery that was, where the oldest gravestone, by the way, is in 1847. That's how old the cemetery is. There's another cemetery that was founded in 1826 that split in two pieces, where my third great-grandfather was buried. He has an intact gravestone that's dated 1875. And it's just a patch on the side of the road that has trees growing through it. Unfortunately, the church, which was a historic church in its day, only has 10 members, and they don't have a lot of money, and they can barely keep up with their sanctuary. So you certainly can't expect them to take care of the cemetery. But it's an area where there's a lot of development in the surrounding areas. And if we weren't vigilant, we might wake up one day, I think, and find out that somebody built, you know, a factory there or something. So we're doing advocacy there as well. But a funny story is, I asked my landscaper how much it would cost to cut all those trees down. He said, oh, about $7,900. I said, I guess we won't be doing that. Well, a Boy Scout troop came along and they needed to do their Eagle Scout badges.
Yeah.
So Boy Scouts with chainsaws took care of that problem for us. And the one thing I really appreciate about that is the power of volunteerism.
Yeah.
And those of us that work on projects like this certainly need to raise money by writing grants and different projects to establish a big budget. But you also have to find a way to motivate people to do work that can be done by us. Why should we, if we had $7,900, we would have spent it on that. But it got done for free because somebody knew how to mobilize. Actually, somebody didn't know how. This was a white Boy Scout who came with his friends and did this for us. So we, I think, need to learn how to mobilize people and inspire them to do the work that needs to be done to preserve our cemeteries and all the different historical projects we need to work on. Was that too long?
No, it's perfect. But you know what? Let me just say this, because I have so many notes. Real quick, Francis Marion University, that's very, very dear to me. I spoke there last year.
Oh, my.
And that's, I'm from Marion County, South Carolina. So
Oh, really?
That was number one. Number two. Excuse me?
My daddy is from Sumter.
Oh, we'll talk. Okay, yes. So then also you noted the power of, you said the power of volunteering, and to me it's the power of advocacy and volunteering, and then correcting the historical narratives, and then what's buried can help tell so many untold stories. So I'm inspired and empowered by all that you're sharing with us. Just amazing. I love what you're doing, the passion for it. And what I'm hoping that this interview will do is inspire other people in their communities. Like, hey, if there's a cemetery and it's not being taken care of, you know, you don't have to wait for someone else to do something. If you see it, be about it, do something about it to make a difference. So, you know, thank you so much for sharing that. One more thing real quick. I'm sitting here going Timbuktu. How did it get its name?
Well, that's a real question. Every time I talk, somebody asks that. So on the one hand, we have the issue of, we know Timbuktu is a faraway, unusual, undesirable place. Like our archaeologist says, his mother says, you're going to send him all the way to Timbuktu if he didn't clean his room. You know, punitive Timbuktu. And that's really how we think about Timbuktu a lot, the word, not the place.
Nothing could be further from the truth.
We don't realize that Timbuktu was a place of wealth, a place of learning, a place of prosperity. If you saw the second iteration of the movie Roots, Kunta Kinte was going to go and study where? In Timbuktu. The first university on the African continent was in Timbuktu. If you, one of our collaborators was Rutgers University, and we had a Timbuktu, I can't remember what we called it, but we have Timbuktu, New York, Timbuktu, New Jersey, and Timbuktu, Mali. We all got together. And it's just, the name is the only commonality we have. It's not like people from Timbuktu in the States come from Mali. But we learned about their ancient manuscripts, which have been in the news a lot because of a civil war and them being destroyed. In the 1600s, we have a recipe for toothpaste, We have complex mathematical calculations. We have information about astrology, astronomy, not astrology. We don't think, no one teaches us that that there was intellectual activity in Africa. So, and then there's, I probably should have bought the quotes. There are a couple of quotes that I have, but essentially it was a place where colonialism had never reached. And so basically leave Black people to their own devices and look how prosperous they are, is essentially what this particular quote says. So we believe that Black people wanted a name that signified Black greatness and Black success. And so they chose a name that signified that. And we don't believe that, some people say that it was chosen because white people didn't like it, so they gave it the negative connotation name. There's no reason to believe that at all. This was a place where Black people were in charge of their destiny, as indicated in that deed recital about the African Union School. That makes sense?
Yes. Thank you.
So I wanted to go back to the cemetery information, because I've been doing a cemetery project for New Jersey. And something that you touched on was the Boy Scouts, number one. A couple of things you touched on. The Boy Scouts, I kind of want to give a bit of a shout out, because in my in some of my research, I have found that at least quite a few cemeteries have been either found, or I should say rediscovered, because of Boy Scouts, because of the work they've done, as well as the power of volunteerism you stated. Another thing that has been really crucial to cemetery preservation. There was a cemetery near in Union County in New Jersey, which is, we can see it now because of a local volunteer, because essentially the church had let it fall into disrepair. It was a segregated cemetery. So it's really interesting that you mentioned that. That seems to be a theme with cemetery preservation, at least in New Jersey. Can you tell us a little bit about, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the folks who are buried at the Timbuktu Cemetery? I know you said there were 11 marked graves, 100 that you seem to be revealed through the ground penetrating radar. Have you been able to kind of identify these people? How has that been going?
Well, we have certainly the military records, the pension files of Civil War soldiers have a lot of information. So we know details about them, and we know not only that they fought in certain battles or that they had achievements or what ranks they reached. We know things like this particular soldier, John Johnson, was the principal of the Timbuktu School after he got out of the military. That says something about him as a person and as an area of interest. In other words, they weren't all farmers. Even though he made a farmer too, he was a person of intellect that was interested in education. And we know that from the pension files. We know there was one soldier who died, and his wife's second husband stole his pension and was prosecuted for it. And there's a funny story behind that. We know there's another funny story about how one soldier, who I believe was my aunt's husband, came out of the military in 1865 after the Civil War, went back in 1867, became a Buffalo Soldier, stayed in the West until 1892, never talked to his wife, but when he came back, she took him back. And after having been married twice to other men who passed away. So that's not honorable, but it's insightful.
Right.
And there's genealogy there, because in that case, my aunt's has children with three different lines of ancestors that I need to pursue, but the pension files, it's the pension file that told me that. So we have those eight soldiers, one more who doesn't have a stone. Then we have three civilian gravestones, all of whom's last name is Parker. I remember I said David Parker was the famous, he obviously had money to buy a stone when no one else had one. Oh, and so his first and second wife and son are all buried in that cemetery. And then, so the very fact that they're the only three civilians, their story behind why they could afford stones and everyone else didn't. Mm. And they're, if I can remember the story, he Our newspaper says he married his third wife after a long and tedious courtship when he was 79 and she was 29.
Whoa.
So, or in his 70s and in her 30s, I'll say more accurately. But then there's a whole narrative around how he was, he outlived all of the Timbuktu founders. He outlived his first wife and his second wife. His third wife was much younger than he. There are funny stories about him in the paper. There are dozens of deeds, There are many deeds and finance and land transactions that he was associated with. But so you learn all that stuff first. Then you come back, you walk into the cemetery, you see Parker. Well, obviously, these are people that are related to him. And then you research further and find out that his first two wives and his son. And actually, to tell you the truth, the only house in Timbuktu that survives today from that era is David Parker's son's house. But nobody knows that except for me and the person who did the research for me. Wow. So that's just a regular old neighborhood house that somebody lives in that they don't even know that it's historic. Mm-hmm. So you would wish that you could do excavations in their backyard to see what you could find, but of course you can't do that. So there's a lot that you learn. We say that in addition to commemorating the dead, cemeteries are repositories of African American history and culture and genealogy. So we have to preserve them because there's so much of our legacy contained in them.
I'm sorry. Not honorable, but insightful. I like that. I'm going to use that when I come across some other either family history or historical history. Not so nice.
For example, my great-grandfather, who's a direct descendant, who I directly descend from, gave testimony for that man's wife to get her pension because he knew that story. And that's written by hand with his signature.
Yes, yeah. Now I saw a picture online before we move on of you, I believe, holding a moonshine jug.
You know, when I missed that because a fan came on in the background and I couldn't hear, so I had to turn the volume up. Say it again, please.
Okay, so there was a moonshine jug that you found?
That's a shame.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was excavating. I shouldn't say excavating. My grandmother, who was developmentally disabled, so therefore I played with her like she was a little kid my whole life. So she would help me in the yard, like cutting grass and digging holes to plant trees and landscaping. And we're digging. And we get this moonshine jug, which looks like the jug that Granny had on the Beverly Hillbillies, if you're old enough to remember that show. And I live in D.C. I'm at my mother's house now, so I don't have the jug with me. I would have bought it. And I said, well, what is this? Clay jug. And one of my neighbors said, oh, your Aunt Rosie, who was born in 1893, to show you the time period. And Henrietta Mitchell had a still. That was probably theirs. And so I have this artifact of my moonshining aunt's illegal activity that I tell funny stories about. But so that was long before the archaeological excavation, but it just goes to show you what you can find buried in the ground. In our, what do I want to say? We have, on a couple of occasions, found interesting things dug into the ground. I was going to say that our house. So my family lived here from 1829 to the era of the Depression. In the first decade of the 20th century, people moved mostly to Philadelphia, and the house eventually burned down. So I suspect there was stuff in the house that just settled into the ground and wasn't taken care of.
Oh, man.
Which is sad. But a moonshine jug was not thought to be of value, certainly. It was just an old jug, right? And so we probably, or maybe when the house burned down and was eventually left by itself, stuff just stayed on the ground and eventually settled into the ground. And so I've also found a couple of nice vases, and I found a gold ring.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Wow. A treasure hunt.
Yes. And so... So I built this house here in 1992, and I lived here in 2000, and my mother came to live in it, and I moved away. But if we had known in 1992 what we know now, we would have done ground penetrating radar first.
Yeah.
And now we know where the house was because neighbors have told us. But I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that would have been found that could have taught us things. And one day we'd still plan to do that. Because I don't know how much the audience knows about ground penetrating radar, but basically can identify where houses were dozens or even 100 years ago and dig around a foundation. And then you could use, in this case, we know who lived here, but you use property records to find out whose house it was and learn a lot that way.
Ooh. Now, how cool would that be if everyone got a chance to do that before they bought a house or moved into a house?
Right. Particularly in our case, when we know that our people live here, but I mean, we didn't know that.
Wow. So what can you share about Timbuktu's development before the Civil War?
So Timbuktu was founded in 1826 when four former enslaved men from Maryland bought parcels from a Quaker businessman. The fifth sale was my fourth great-grandfather. Then in the following years, it was never really big, but since every couple of years, a couple of different land transactions would occur. But the evidence we have of the early development are the institution, the African Union School, and the Amy Zion Church. There was a beneficial society of the United Sons and Daughters of Timbuktu, which was a self-help society. And all of these organizations either have deeds because they own property or they have articles of incorporation. We can see what who was a member and what their mission was. We have the newspaper, the New Jersey Mirror, which gives us the obituary of the various different people. So we have a greater sense of what happened. Basically, four formerly enslaved men came to live here. But in 1830, 96 or 97% of Black people living in South Jersey were free already. So it wasn't just formerly enslaved people, it was also people who were living here already. And you can just see that they founded a church in 1826, which is still there. They founded another church in 1840s or 50s, which I've talked about before. You can read the minutes. The M.A. Zion Church and the A.N.E. Church have minutes of their conferences. And so you know, for example, that the churches existed, how many members they had, who the pastor was. So you get a basic story from which you can fill in the blanks. But the thing that struck me the most, I'm just going to read you the recital from the from the school deed that says, whereas in the settlement of Timbuktu and the vicinity there are many people of color, so-called, who seem sensible of the advantages of a suitable school education and are destitute for a house for that purpose. And they said Peter Choir and Maria, his wife, in consideration of the premises and the affection they bear for the people of color and the desire they have to promote their true and best interests are minded to settle, give, grant, and convey said premises to the uses and intents hereinafter pointed out and described. And then it goes on to add the part that in order to be a trustee, you have to be a person of color that lived within 10 miles of the premises. So much information there. Number one, I thought Jesse Jackson founded coined the term people of color. I didn't know we called ourselves that 150 or 200 years ago. I didn't know that Black people could file a document in the county clerk's office and say, this is FUBU. So white people stay out, basically. I didn't know that Peter Choir and Maria, his wife, who gave the land, were Black people who owned, enough resources that could cut off a piece of their backyard and give it for a school. And so you read a recital like that, and there are a couple of them, and you begin to get images of what life was like for this small community. Not all peaches and cream, because that school got burned down. And my fourth year grandfather put a school until they were able to rebuild it. But the fact of the matter is they could build it in the first place. They could make it FUBU and say it was FUBU. White people burned it down. They built it back up. So there's one step back, two steps forward, two steps back, three steps forward.
Right.
And those are the most striking examples of what Timbuktu was like for me.
I think that's going to be the name of our show, FUBU, for us.
It's, you know, I'm listening to you and this is just like oozing out of you. So my question is how, what's the length of time that you've been involved in this. Like, to me, it's just so powerful to be in a community, to know the history, and that your ancestors are involved in all of that history. To me, that would be so overwhelming, I guess, emotionally. I'll give you an example. If Chiricana doesn't mind me sharing what happened over the weekend, we went to hear Bernice Bennett speak at the African American Museum, the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. It was powerful. There was so much energy in the room. And it's like, oh, wow, it was just like I was a kid in a candy store from that energy and meeting people that you've been talking to. One of our members, you know, Chiricana and I run our local Ox chapter here in New Jersey. And one of our members who lives in Michigan, we got to meet her for the first time. So it was just so moving. And so afterwards, my friend and I, we said, okay, well, we're going to go take a tour after we decided not to have lunch because the line was just so, so long, right?
Yeah.
It was really popular restaurant. So long story short, you know, we just decided to leave and go get something to eat and, you know, said we'd come back another time. And so Chiricana sent me this image the following day. They were there for the weekend. And the image was of I would say it's a placard, Chiricana, like a poster, you know,
this placard
in the museum for the slave exhibit of a portion of of the slave narrative of my second great grandmother.
Oh my goodness.
And so when I saw that, Chiricana actually went onto their website and it's also on the website. And so I thought about it, I digested it, I did my best not to call her, and I can't wait to go back, but it was so moving to me that Chiricana said to me, if I had not shared that story, there's a full slave narrative. I've talked about her. If I hadn't shared that story, she would have looked at it probably and been like, oh, okay, you know, look at this. But she said she gasped when she saw it. And I said to her, I said, God knew what he was doing for me to be tired and come back home. Because if I had walked into that exhibit, the line was long, right into it. But if I had walked into that exhibit, it would have been security or 911. I just envisioned myself like passing out, literally just passing out from seeing something like that. So that's why I'm saying for you, what does it feel like, you know, just to be engrossed in the history, like to know, to learn it, to know it. And it's your history. So the first part is, how long have you been involved in this history? And then secondly, I really want to know, and we want our listeners to know, what does it feel like to be a part of this, to be, you know, to be connected to history where it's past, present, and then because you're so involved in telling the story, future, past, present, future, what does that feel like? And then how long?
Well, that's a very substantial question. I'll say that one thing I didn't talk about was, and I'll try to say it very concisely. One of my grandmother's first cousins invited us, my mother and me, to her house to give us a family property, which ended up being all these handwritten documents that I told you about. So that was the beginning, because I ended up having to do research to, we had to settle. This is one of those cases where one generation would live here, have a deed, pass it on to the next generation. And it was all the same deed, never new names. And so we had to do what was called a quiet title action so that all of my great-great-grandfather's siblings' descendants could claim their piece if they wanted it. Fortunately, nobody knew what the great-great-grandfather's name is, so I didn't have any resistance. But in doing that, I had to research to find the names of those ancestors. And that was the beginning, because it was a matter of do this or you can't build your house. And that was all it was about then. But then I was struck by the fact that the information was there for me to know that this person born in my great-great-grandfather was born in 1857. I have all of his brothers and sisters' birth and death records because we did that in New Jersey. And so that was the beginning, but then after that, that was 1992 or so, I didn't get back in, and I did a little here and there on and off for 20 years, but it wasn't until the archaeologist came here in 2009 that I really began to research. So I'll say substantially maybe 15 years, but if you count every year, it goes back almost 30 years. And it's really something that's part of my every day or every week I'm doing something related to this. And so you begin to remember things. I tell people that it's not that I'm a great writer or a great speaker. I just have a great story to tell. And that's not something that I wrote. It's something that my ancestors left me.
I have a great story to tell. Wow. And that's, and how do you feel? Like, that's your feeling, that I have a great story to tell?
Yeah, I also feel it's funny because I feel extremely gratified. Sometimes I feel guilty because you can spend, if you spend a week researching this, you can write a book. Mm-hmm. If you spend a week researching my father's relatives in Sumter, you might get a page. Because I've neglected my father's ancestors because they're more difficult to research. And so I've committed to carving out time to learn more about them. But it's funny because you feel like you're telling the same story over and over again, but the audience is always different. And there's always some new tidbit that you found that you didn't know before. So,
well, all of this is totally different from when I saw you over the summer, which is oh, really? So powerful. Yeah. I mean, some of the components are the same, but it's just more involved. And I'm like, yeah. Oh my gosh. So I'm hoping that a book will come out, that you will write your story.
We are certainly hoping so. Right now I'm working on the, I don't know if you're familiar with the process to put a site on the National and Local and New Jersey Registers of Historic Places. That is like, almost a master's thesis. And so once I'm finished with that, a lot of the pieces of that are foundational for book chapters. And I probably can crank it out in several months after that. So I'm hoping that happens in the next 18 months.
That is awesome. Man, this is just like, you got your work cut out for you, that's for sure.
Yeah, the only thing I need is to win the lottery so I could do this full time.
Oh, now you sounded like Gus Jericho.
You're not going to eat, right? You're not going to eat.
We just want to research all day.
That's right. I wouldn't love to fit. Like today, this was a busy day for me because I had a talk at noon and then a reporter coming to talk to us at 3, and then I'll have you here. And we have the documents, like all those deeds and stuff. And so they're all fragile. Not fragile, but they're delicate. You don't want to just... You need to touch them with gloves. And so I'm placing them carefully on the table, reading what they say. It's a very tedious process. And my mother was telling me how I need to find a way to make it easier, like label them or something. That's like, it's not tedious to me at all. I love what I'm doing. I like to be able to. And not only one of the things about the documents is, this is a document that's been touched by any generation of my family going back 200 years.
Wow.
So I'm blessed to touch it and look at it every day.
That's a great way to look at it. Yes. And you what? Say that again?
And the moonshine jug is the same. I mean, I don't drink whiskey, but my aunt made corn whiskey in this jug, right? So I'm going to celebrate every time I see it.
Hey, nothing wrong with that. So you've written articles for the Oggs Journal prior to becoming the editor. So one article you wrote about finding your fourth great grandmother, Anne Barnes Brewer Hall. Can you share with us? We'd love to hear what you discovered about her.
Well, I discovered first back in 1992 that she was born in Philadelphia in the 1790s. From researching her, I learned that Philadelphia around that time had the largest free Black population, largest Black population in the country, most of whom were free going back. Pennsylvania was the first state to pass the manumission law in 1780. And so what does that say, Pennsylvania? Again, not that all Black people were treated nicely, but it's different. Right. The South was. It's funny. I didn't learn as much. And so I learned that she came from a free family. Her sister was a member of Mother Bethel AME Church, which is still there if you know AME churches.
Yep.
I learned a lot of interesting things about her sister. Her sister was what was called a shrouder, which is an archaic word for mortician, essentially. And she worked in cholera and typhoid fever epidemics and she was not as afraid as everybody else. Therefore, she had a lot of money and she lived in a 3-story brick house in what is now like the 300 block of South 6th Street, right around the corner from Mother Bethel, which is, we call it Society Hill now, but the point is, it was a three-story brick house in the 1840s. Who lived in a house like that? A woman who was, for whatever reason, dedicated enough to her work to tend to the bodies of dead people that died of contagious diseases. And she died in 1865, but in 1905, the Philadelphia Tribune wrote an article about Black cemeteries. They mentioned her as a noted shrouder who was unflinching in her tending to people who had died. And her, the city directory in Philadelphia called her a layer out. What's a layer out? Somebody who lays people out, right? In other words,
we use that differently now.
My grandmother would say
a layer out.
She would go to a funeral. Oh, they really had him laid out nice. Well, that's what a layer out was.
Oh.
That laid out, different layout.
Okay. Right? Now you're bringing up, oh, you're going up, which is awake, but they would call it in the South, they call it, you going to the sitting up or the setting up.
Well, I've heard that. That I learned that term recently, but I guess the point is from that, there are, there's a generation, in her generation, there are a couple of morticians. Well, it wasn't her generation, it was the generation after her, my great-grandmother's my great-grandmother's generation. People that I knew as a child into my teens and 20s that were morticians.
Wow.
So now I need to go back and I can find, I know where they worked in the 1920s, but this mortuary, the same one that she worked in, although they knew the term mortuary and mortician, I'm not sure of what the language was, but the point is we had funeral directors, undertaker, that was the word they used in my family. And now I know where that comes from. And I would obviously like to see, they were, because she died and left this three-story brick house and a substantial estate for a Black person in her day in 1865 in Philadelphia, where are those relatives now? They've got to be, we have no idea who they are, but it will be easy enough for me to find out if I just took the time. So I think the biggest thing that I learned was about this sister of my fourth great grandmother and how she was a noted person in her own right. As far as my fourth great grandmother was concerned, every decade you would see her doing something different. Like my fourth great grandfather died. She married Hezekiah Hall, the guy who was a slave of Charles Carroll of Carrollton. But then he died, and she was working as a maid in the house of an alcohol merchant. She lied about her age. She said she was 15 years younger than she was. Probably so she'd get a job as a maid, because they wouldn't hire a 55-year-old woman if they knew she was 55, but if they thought she was 42 or whatever she said she was, they would hire her. That begins to paint pictures. And then the next decade, you see that she's living back on the family here where I am now as the matriarch. But you just get pictures based on these little pieces and you try to put them together.
Right.
And the most striking thing was the story about her sister.
That is pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
I was just looking at a post on social media about the history of Black funeral home directors and, you know, the important role they played because of discrimination, and white funeral home directors wouldn't deal with the bodies. And so funeral home directing became like a pathway basically to the middle class.
Right, right. And that was what I thought of when I thought of this.
Yeah.
But the other thing that's funny, that she was female.
Right, and right. That's a really striking thing.
Apparently that was not uncommon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's in my research about her. It was not uncommon.
Wow.
And that changed later, obviously. But in her day, that was not uncommon. And her daughter was a shrouder as well.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. That's like another book right there.
Right.
I think he has several, Terry Connor. He has several pieces, you know. Oh my god!
A whole life. You just need like a whole library shelf just dedicated to Guy Weston.
Well, I don't know about that. No, I guess people know this, but even so, I found that she was first listed as a undertaker in a city directory in the 1840s. And you read those and you see all kinds of, not many, 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 but certainly substantial numbers of Black people who have, because it says colored, or see in parentheses, you know, it's a Black person, that were teachers or that were ministers. that were people obviously that had businesses that obviously were able to provide more for themselves. And so we have this history where on the one hand, we know that Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and others existed, but there were all kinds of rank and file Black people that had professions, that owned businesses that, relatively speaking, did well for themselves, that there are stories about that we can learn from and be inspired by.
Very true.
Absolutely. So based on all of your research experience and writing, please share some parting words of inspiration with our listeners.
I wish I could. I hope that I can make people understand how gratifying it is to do their own research. This is fascinating for us. You find out things you wouldn't even imagine about your ancestors that you can relate to. And it's become easier in recent time with technology of digitized records online and DNA research and so forth. It's not as hard as you think. I've had, there's some cases where you put in a person's name, you do know this, and you have to verify what you learn, but you can get three or four generations of information in an hour sometimes. Then you have to go back and verify, but you'd be surprised at the places that it takes you. And so since that aunt, the Shrouder, was an early member, one of her nephews, my great-great-grandfather's obituary said she was a member of Richard Allen's church, 6 and Pine Street, Philadelphia. A founder of Richard Allen's church, 6 and Pine Street, Philadelphia. So I need to, that's another thing that I need to pursue. I mean, who of Richard Allen's peers am I related to? I can be related to him for all I know. I'm not saying that I am, but I mean.
Yeah, yeah. No,
one thing that we don't realize is how, in Oz Journal this month, I put this graphic of how you have four grandparents, 8 great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents, 32, 3 great-grandparents. And so the descendants of all those lines don't know each other now. And right. So there are all kinds of people that could be in your past and you don't know about it. If you see, for example, Finding Your Roots, every once in a while, Henry Louis Gates will tell somebody who they're related to that they didn't know his family. But a good one is, I don't know if you knew that Barack Obama and Dick Cheney are distant cousins.
Yes, I did hear that. Yep.
Uh-huh. Right. And so they're all kinds of, or Dan Quayle and George Bush were distant cousins.
Yep.
So we have all kinds of distant cousins that we don't know about that we would be shocked to find out about. And sometimes you like them, sometimes you don't, but it's still a learning experience.
Yep. Barry Gordy and Jimmy Carter.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that one.
Yep. So it's very true. Very true. Yeah. It is. That's very true. Doing family history is very gratifying and it can blow your mind. Some of the things you find for sure.
Right. And so one of my goals, and I think I need to wind it down, is there needs to be a television miniseries about free Black people. You had like 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. but still that was as informative as it was. You wouldn't conclude from that the main character in that movie was Solomon Northrop. There were many Solomon Northrop in New York where he lived. He was not the only one who owned a house who had a business. Right. And so when we learn about them, we should need to see them on television. It can't just be, you know, underground of people escaping. That's part of the narrative, but it's only a piece.
Very true.
We have more than one story. There's one ancestor that's connected to my family. And his name is Basil Dorsey. And his story is just phenomenal. You know, where he was enslaved and, you know, they told him, oh, well, if you raise this amount of money, we'll free you. And does that. And they're like, yeah, well, it's going to cost a little bit more. And he and his brothers were like, yeah, we're out of here. We're out. And their story, you know, it's just phenomenal. It's a phenomenal story. So there's so many untold stories and nobody can tell it and research it. You should do it. I wrote that down. Do your own research. So absolutely. Powerful.
Absolutely.
That's right. Powerful. That's right. Well, Guy, thank you so much for sharing with us and our listeners.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, we had a great time. And can you let our listeners know how they can find out more about you and your work?
Well, we have a website, which is called timbuktunewjersey.com. That's www.timbuktunj.com. Timbuktu is spelled T-I-M-B-U-C-T-O-O.
Awesome.
You can contact me through the site as well.
Okay, great. So we thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.